Chapter 5. The Manipulation of Education. The third way the global media is controlling the narrative to control our minds is with books and education. You see, newspapers, radio and music are not the only subliminal manipulative technologies that are being used on us on a global scale by a small group of aliens, I mean rich elites around the world. Believe it or not, books and the whole educational system is as well. They too are out there swaying our minds subconsciously, telling us what to buy and consume, and even instruct our minds to go back to sleep, never question authority, obey and believe whatever the rich elitists want us to believe, including the need to scoff at the things of God. So, again, let's keep those glasses on and see how these next media technologies, called books and the whole educational system, are being used to manipulate the minds of the masses on a huge global scale. Frankly, as we saw with the other technologies, this manipulation that's being done with books and education has been going on for quite some time now, whether people realize it or not. So, let's take a look at how books themselves began.
Narrator. There's no better way to spend a cold rainy day than to be curled up with a book you love. But who actually invented books in the first place?
The very first forms of writing date back almost 6,000 years ago, to an ancient people called the Sumerians, who started etching in their early alphabet into moist clay tablets using a triangular tool called a calamus. The clay was then fired in a kiln to harden. This new ability, writing things down, proved to be popular, and for the next 1,000 or so years, tablets were the only good way to do it.
That's until papyrus scrolls came along.
The oldest known scrolls date back to ancient Egypt, almost 4,500 years ago. Papyrus is a thick material made from thin strands of papyrus plant stem glued together that's more like a fabric than a paper.
This was an upgrade from the heavy clay tablets, but scrolls still weren't simple. They were usually between 10 and 50 feet long, and usually took two hands to use them because they were so heavy.
The papyrus would also crack easily, but before long the Romans had a solution. They created the Codex, which sounds like a secret gadget but is just a series of scrolls that were bound together and opened like a book. The wooden covers protected the pages, which were now made from a material called parchment, made from animal skins. Over in China, the earliest books were made of thin pieces of bamboo bound together with hemp, silk or leather.
Sometime between 618 and 907, the very first books were printed in China.
They were made using a time-consuming method called woodblock printing, where the words are carved into wood and stamped onto pages. In the 1040s, a Chinese man named Bai Sheng invented movable type printing, which used pre-made character blocks made of ceramic or clay. This design would later be improved on by Johannes Gutenberg, who invented the printing press. This changed everything, because for the first time, books were mass-produced quickly. Before the printing press, people only copied a couple of pages per day, but now thousands of pages could be produced. That means that books, and the incredible knowledge they can contain, became available for more and more people at cheaper and cheaper prices. Today, books are all made from using the same basic process. The words are printed on big sheets of paper, which are cut into smaller pages, double the length of a book.
Those pages are then folded in half and sewn together.
Finally, the sewn and folded pages are cut to final size and glued to the spine of the book's cover. Today, what we think of as a book is always changing. Ebooks, audiobooks, and other digital readers are becoming a bigger and bigger part of daily life. But most experts agree that physical, bound books will never go away completely.
In other words, it's still changing how we access this medium method called books that molds our minds and allows us to receive information. Just like newspapers, radio, and music, once this manipulative technology called books sprung into existence, especially in the last century, it too began to spread across the whole planet. And that's why today, we have an estimated 2.2 million new books produced every single year in over 120 different countries around the globe. And access to them and delivery of them is easier than ever before. Thanks to the internet and global entities like Amazon, just about anybody, anywhere on the planet, can buy just about any kind of book you can think of, on whatever topic you can dream of. And now, books are getting even more diverse and widespread with new global technologies that have appeared on the scene, literally in just the last few of years. Of course, is the new form of print media or books out there now are called electronic or digital books and even audiobooks. And, boy, have they taken off like wildfire. Right now, electronic e-books make up 19% of total book sales and the global e-book market was valued at $18.13 billion, not million but billion, in 2020. but they are now expected to reach 28.73 billion by 2026. And speaking of Amazon, their share of the ebook market is 67%, although some analysts would say it's as high as 83%. Either way, that is a whole lot of control over this new electronic book media technology in the hands of just one alien, I mean rich elite entity. But other global ebook elites include Sony, Apple, and Google, just to name a few. Then there's the other new book media technology out there called audiobooks. Sales of audiobooks have skyrocketed as well in recent years and have actually become the biggest book industry trend for the last 7 years. Sales of audiobooks increased by nearly 25% in 1 year alone, and total sales are in the billions and are now even eclipsing ebook sales. They have become super popular. In fact, over 90% of audiobooks are sold and downloaded from the internet, which means anyone from anywhere around the whole planet can now have access to them. That is, for now. And I say that because, as you can see, it is common sense. Books, including the new ebooks and audiobooks, have become a very important tool to share information, educate, or even mold the minds of people for good or for bad. Therefore, once again, whoever controls the media of books, in all its various forms, has yet another powerful tool to manipulate the minds of the masses around the planet, including the usage of them in the educational system that utilizes the same books as a part of their teaching curriculum, which we will get into soon enough. And believe it or not, that control of the media of books, on a global basis, is already here. Just like with newspapers, radio, and music, now even books are now in the hands of just a few aliens, I mean rich elites. In fact, they are not even hiding it anymore. They simply call themselves the Big Five publishers. These would include:
Number 1. Penguin Random House. Annual revenue: $3.3 billion. Notable imprints: Knopf Doubleday, Crown Publishing, Viking Press. Penguin Books and Random House, PRH, is not only a Big Five publisher, it's considered to be the biggest publishing house in the industry. It has over 200 divisions and imprints, in addition to those listed above. Number 2. Hachette Lever. Annual revenue: $2.7 billion. Notable imprints: Grand Central Publishing, Little, Brown & Company, Mulholland Books. Hachette Lever is one of the most prominent publishers in all of Europe. Number 3. HarperCollins. Annual revenue: $1.5 billion. Notable imprints: Avon Romance, Harlequin Enterprises, Harper, William Morrow. HarperCollins was created in 1989 through a multi-company merger, taking its name from former publishing giants Harper and Row and William Collins. Number 4. Macmillan Publishers. Annual revenue: $1.4 billion. Notable imprints: Farrar, Strauss and Giroux, Picador, Thomas Dunn Books. Macmillan Publishers are another prong of the Holtzbrinck Publishing Group empire. The current incarnation of Macmillan was formed through a 2015 merger, even though it has an illustrious history dating back to 1843, publishing the original works of authors like Lewis Carroll, Rudyard Kipling and W.B. Yeats. Number 5. Simon & Schuster. Annual revenue: $830 million. Notable imprints: Howard Books, Scribner, Touchstone. Simon & Schuster was founded in 1924 and is now a subsidiary of CBS Corporation.
Wow. That's a lot of control in just the hands of a few aliens, I mean rich elites. As one article bluntly stated, together, these institutions dominate the publishing landscape, and many of the most beloved books come from their imprints. In other words, these few publishing entities control all the books on the whole planet, just like all the other forms of media. Anybody starting to see a pattern here? In fact, the same is true of another global form of print media called magazines. Here is the top 12 U.S. consumer magazine publishers:
Time Incorporated, Condé Nast Publications, Meredith, American Media Incorporated, Winter Media, The Reader's Digest Association, Bauer Publishing, Bonnier, Rodale, National Geographic Society, Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia.
And whether people realize it or not, even these print magazines, let alone books, are admittedly yet another form of media manipulation used today by a handful of elites on a global basis to mesmerize the minds of the masses. Don't believe me? Here is just one secular entity admitting it:
Penny Cousineau-Levine, author. The power of the image came to us first in magazines. Their combination of words and pictures was truly liberating. Evan Solomon, journalist and broadcaster. Magazines give you instructions, debunk myths on how you see the world. Change the way you see the world. Penny Cousineau-Levine. The force that liberates can also imprison. Magazines have opened the world up. But we seem unable to exist outside this hall of mirrors. How do we begin to come out from underneath that, from these messages of who we should be and what we should look like and how we should live? Narrator.
This is the story of the first international medium and the influence on every aspect of who we are.
Magazines are everywhere and about everything.
They tell us what to wear, what to buy, name a subject and there is a magazine about it. Magazines for news junkies, cigar smokers, PC gamers, and poodle owners. The ever-present magazine industry oversees trillions of dollars.
Such a presence, for better or worse, translates into an extraordinary influence.
Magazines can enhance democracy or constrain it.
They can bring us meaning and perspective or distract us from what truly matters.
But with our newsstands already overflowing with glossy pages of mindless, fleeting, useless information, do we still even need the great magazines?
Evan Solomon.
Some people ask why magazines are important, will they survive and what role do they play in society?
And I am a great believer that storytelling is a fundamental element in society. When I say story, I don't mean fiction. I mean it's the narrative that helps you orient your life. It may be a sacred narrative, one that you believe is from God, or it may be a secular one. The narratives that we tell each other help to shape who we are, how to make decisions. Those are part of the narratives that help shape who we are. Narrator. Who we are and what we want to be.
It inspired, debated, and promoted inside the great magazines. From Gutenberg's printing press and Eric Solomon's candid photographs to the scenes on the World Wide Web, the great magazines thrive and shape our world with the images, words, and ideas that form the narratives of our lives.
That is now coming from a handful of elites. They even admit it. It's crazy, folks. But correct me if I'm wrong, this sure is starting to sound a whole lot like that movie scene we saw earlier. In light of what we just saw, tell me if this is not what is happening today.
A clip from the movie They Live. As the main character walks down the street, he comes to a store window that has a small sign saying Consume. He takes the glasses off and looks at the sign again, and sees that it says Close Out Sale. The glasses that he found in a box near the trash container are allowing him to see things that he wouldn't normally see. When he puts them back on and looks down the street, he is now seeing signs that have words on them like, watch TV, buy, conform, work 8 hours, sleep 8 hours, play 8 hours, obey. In unbelief, he walks a little farther down the street to the magazine stand. Again, the words that are showing up on the magazines are not what is supposed to be on them, like obey, stay asleep, no thought, submit. He pulls one of the magazines off the rack and flips through the pages to see if the same strange things are inside. He sees obey, stay asleep, do not question authority, buy, watch TV, no imagination. He pulls the glasses down and looks at the page, and he sees the normal article in print. He puts the glasses back on, and as he does it, another man walks up to the stand. When he looks at the man, he is shocked to see an alien standing next to him. He can't help but stare at the man. When the man realized that someone is staring at him, he asks, "What's your problem?" Immediately he takes the glasses off, and the alien looks like a normal man in a gray suit. The alien repeats, "I said, what's your problem?"
My problem is this, that movie is starting to sound like our reality. I mean, the further we go into our study, the less that movie sounds like a crazy science fiction conspiracy theory, doesn't it? Rather, this subliminal media manipulation, even with print media, books, magazines, you name it, really is going on, from a handful of rich elites just like in that movie scene. And lest you doubt, observe this. Just like in that movie premise, these print media companies are not only owned by a handful of aliens, I mean rich elites, but they even admit why they have bought up so many of these print media companies. They freely admit it is in order to manipulate people into thinking and behaving how they want us to think and behave. I'm not joking. Here's just one example of an alien, I mean rich billionaire, who recently bought Time magazine, and listen to why he said he bought it.
Newscaster. First of all, I was talking to Mark last night. He's very excited about this. Why is he doing this? Why are they doing this, I should say? Because Lynn is involved as well. Nico Grant, Bloomberg Technology. Yeah, and I think that is crucial. Mark Benioff has tried to pitch himself as a civic leader, and I really think he wants to become part of the conversation when it comes to criticism of President Trump and his policies, or when it comes to sharing his progressive values. He tends to be pretty outspoken. And I think that when you see the institution like Time Magazine, he thinks this is a perfect brand. It's a perfect opportunity to save a news outlet that has done really great work and give him an additional platform. Newscaster. Here is a tweet from Mark Benioff. Mark Benioff. The power of Time has always been in its unique storytelling of the people and issues that affect us all and connect us all. A treasure trove of our history and culture. We have deep respect for their organization and honored to be stewards of this iconic brand. Newscaster. John, you know this as Jeff Bezos has bought the Washington Post. You've got Lorraine Powell Jobs, and The Atlantic, as Nico said, Mark Benioff, and many of these tech magnates, not shy at all about their political views. What does that mean for the publication and the media?
Well, it means that it's being controlled by a handful of aliens, I mean rich elites, who admit it gives them a huge media platform to manipulate the minds of the masses according to their desires. They even admit it, as you saw. All I was waiting for was that billionaire guy to turn his head to the camera and say, like that alien did in that movie, "What's your problem?" This is nuts, folks. Rich elites, just like in that movie premise, really are using print media of all its forms, including books and magazines, to control and manipulate us on a global scale, along with newspapers, radio, and music. And only those who have the right glasses on can see this, which is precisely why we are doing this documentary. We are trying to hand you the glasses. Don't take them off. In fact, if you were paying attention there, you saw it wasn't just one alien, I mean one rich elite, doing this. Rather, it was a handful of other billionaires doing it as well. People like Lorraine Powell Jobs, the wife of Steve Jobs, who bought The Atlantic, and billionaire Jeff Bezos of Amazon, who bought The Washington Post. They too admit that this will help them control the narrative, i.e., manipulate people into what they want us to think and behave, let alone believe, as this article admits.
Mark Benioff is just the most recent tech billionaire to buy a media company, that of Time Magazine. In July 2017, the Emerson Collective, an organization run by the philanthropist and billionaire widow of Apple Steve Jobs, Lorraine Powell Jobs, bought a major stake in The Atlantic magazine. The 160-year-old publication is one of the country's most important and enduring journalistic institutions, Jobs said in a July statement, and Emerson Collective plan to ensure that The Atlantic continues to fulfill its critical mission at this critical time.
Gee, I wonder what that mission is?
In June, the former surgeon and biotech billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong bought the Los Angeles Times, the San Diego Union-Tribune, and several community newspapers for $500 million. Billionaire Jeff Bezos says he bought the Washington Post for similar reasons. Bezos told an audience at the Economic Club of Washington, D.C., on September 13 about agreeing to buy the company. "As soon as I started thinking about it, it was like, this is an important institution. It is the newspaper in the capital city in the most important country in the world. The Washington Post has an incredibly important role to play in this democracy. There's just no doubt in my mind about that. I think you could make an argument that certainly Jeff Bezos has more influence in Washington now than he would if he had not purchased the Washington Post."
No kidding. Anyone starting to see a pattern here? That movie is simply becoming our reality. In fact, do not take those glasses off yet. Unfortunately, it's about to get even worse. These aliens, I mean rich elites, are not only controlling and manipulating the minds of the masses by buying up all the print media and books for their own nefarious purposes. But now, it has even gotten easier for them to manipulate and control the information people are receiving from them. And this is being done via the new electronic formats that we saw, where various forms of print media are being turned into. That is, the e-books, the audiobooks, and even e-magazines, etc. All these electronic formats enable the elites to restrict, eliminate, or even erase altogether anything that they don't want us to come across in print, with just the click of a mouse. And that would include anything that might expose what they're really up to and or goes against their pre-programmed narrative that they are forcing us to ingest via these book formats. I mean, think about it. At least with an actual physical book or other physical form of print media like a physical magazine, you can at least have it stored in your personal possession to read anytime you want or store it away for future use or for future reference. But now, with all these new and ever-expanding electronic digital and audio books as well as digital magazines, since they're electronic, this means they can all be wiped out with a click of a mouse, and no one would even know. All information becomes controlled, deleted, forbidden in just a matter of seconds on a global basis because you made it all electronic. Do you see the pattern? That's called thought control, and it gives the elites yet another layer of total global control over the minds of the masses. No wonder these aliens, I mean rich elites, are buying up all kinds of print media companies like candy, including all the electronic forms. Why, the next thing you know, if this keeps up, we will have to start memorizing books in order to have any left to read. Which is strangely starting to sound like another science fiction movie scenario, that of Fahrenheit 451. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with that book or movie, let's remind ourselves of its premise.
Fahrenheit 451 is a 1953 dystopian novel by American writer Ray Bradbury. The book presents a future American society where books are outlawed and firemen burn any that are found. The book's tagline explains the title as the temperature at which book paper catches fire and burns, the auto-ignition temperature of paper. The lead character is a fireman who becomes disillusioned with his role of censoring literature and destroying knowledge, eventually quitting his job and committing himself to the preservation of literary and cultural writings. He made his way to the countryside and contacted exiled book lovers who lived there. These drifters are all former intellectuals. They have each memorized the books should the day arrive that society comes to an end and is forced to rebuild itself anew, with the survivors learning to embrace the literature of the past. The fireman is asked what he has to contribute to the group, and he finds that he had partially memorized the book of Ecclesiastes.
Notice it was a biblical book that was essential to rebuilding society. Oh, how I wish we would get back to that mindset today. Unfortunately, as we will see here shortly, the Bible and Christian teachings are being banned and deleted as well from our culture by these same elites controlling all of the print material. But, wonder of wonders, this dystopian Fahrenheit 451 mentality is no longer just a science fiction book or movie premise. Rather, it is actually going on today, and they've even come out recently with a new and improved version of it. Gee, I wonder why. Let's check it out.
Clip from New Fahrenheit 451. The scene opens with one of the main characters standing on a pile of books. He is holding two books, one in each hand. He holds them up and begins to speak. Now, have any of you guys seen one of these bad things for real? He bangs them together and the crowd cheers. We burned nearly every physical book in the country. So, by the time you guys grow up, there won't be one book left. The books are then set on fire. The next scene has another character holding a book that is opened, and he asks the one that had burned the books, "Do you know what is inside a book?" Insanity. The main character gets curious and opens a book to see what is inside. He realizes that what he has been doing to all those books may not be right. It looks like he may have a change of heart. His friend tells him that they are onto him. He has hidden a book in his room and is now reading it. The next scene is a group of underground book savers. He starts to help them but knows if he is caught, he is dead. The danger is real. And they are onto him and the underground group. He tries to get them to safety. His boss says to him, "Words are a terror, son, I know. Knowledge is a dangerous thing." Before the story is over, there is a battle to save the books, but, as the students watch the books burn, they cheer once again. Not knowing what they are losing as the books burn.
Yeah, burn those books or delete those books, or filter people's access to them and information altogether like those elites say. I mean, after all, they know better, we can trust them. Yeah, right. So, is it just a mere coincidence that in our lifetime, nearly 70 years later after the original, they just happen to be coming out with this new remake of Fahrenheit 451? Or could it very well be to prepare us for our day to have the exact same mentality of book burning that these elites are really bringing to the whole planet in order to control us? Now, lest you doubt that these rich elites would actually do something like that, that is, to actually filter or even restrict or delete, burn or ban what information you can get from the various forms of print media. Just like in the book and movie Fahrenheit 451, the reality is, they're not only already doing it, as they admitted earlier, but the facts are they've been doing it for quite some time now, whether you realize it or not. In fact, I learned this myself the hard way, some 15 years ago in the book publishing world, as a brand new author. Back then, I did what everybody told me that you needed to do as an up-and-coming young author, and that is, you must get an agent. So, I did, and that's when my eyes began to be opened as to what was really going on behind the scenes in the book publishing world that nobody, including myself at that time, was even aware of. You see, I thought when it came to publishing a book, that it all was based on the quality and importance and value of the book's information, created by the author. I thought if a book had good content and was good for the public and was a great read, that surely it will be made available to the public right away. Value and the creativity are what makes a book go on the shelf, right? Boy, was I living under a rock. I was shocked, to say the least, when I was personally told by my last seasoned agent that what really drives the books making it to the market or on the bookshelves in bookstores, as well as in the online community, was nothing about value or creativity or inspiration of author's material in the book. Rather, what determined a book's selection for the bookshelves was the new trend he called, market-driven. So, I naturally asked, what's market-driven? And he actually stated, the only books that get picked up by the publishers are the ones that are hot on the market. So, then I asked, well, who or what determines what books are hot for the market? And he actually responded, the publishers do. So, I thought to myself, wait a second. The book publishers are determining what people get because the book publishers are determining what's hot. This means the whole industry of publishing books has nothing to do with whether or not you as an author just wrote the greatest book since sliced bread or that it has anything about the public's desires or wishes. Rather, it is all based on what the publishers want you to read. No book today will ever make it to market, i.e., be published, other than what the book publishers declare as a hot item. This is not an open free market system where people and authors can share their open and honest opinions or ideas in books or other various print media. No. It is total control of what people read through a close lop system created by these publishers that they call market driven, which is only a code word for them determining what you get to read. Which really is step one of the Fahrenheit 451 scenario. Books, including their various electronic forms, are not only in the hands of just a few aliens, I mean rich elites, but they really are controlling the narrative and information people are receiving from them by filtering the books coming out according to their agenda. This is nothing but propaganda, brainwashing, whatever you want to call it, and it is really going on. But on the other hand, it's not so surprising, because it's following the exact same pattern these elites use with all the other forms of media that we've been looking at. Books and various forms of print media, just like newspapers, radio, and music, really are being used on a global basis to manipulate the minds of the masses. They are controlling it all. All forms of modern media are being used to drive out, on a global basis, a pre-selected pre-programmed specific message that these elites want us to hear or read for their own private agenda to manipulate us into thinking whatever they want us to think, behave or believe, whether we realize it or not. It's just now we're getting hit from three technological angles all at the same time, every single day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And wonder of wonders, this privatized control of what people are receiving from books today by these elites is not only controlling the narrative, but it's also aiding in the rise of immoral behavior that the Bible predicted would appear on the scene when you're living in the last days. Let's look at that passage again.
2 Timothy 3:1-5. But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Have nothing to do with them.
But, when it comes to books today, that's about all we're getting from them. Total immoral behavior. Think about the books that are on the bookshelves today, whether you want it or not, that these same book publishers, these elites are cramming into our brains. Remember, it is not on the shelf because we want it or our desire is demanding it. No. Rather, it is what they are choosing for us because it's market-driven, remember? Yeah, whatever. And so, what are the books they are forcing us to read? Well, shocker, every single one of those wicked behaviors that God said will destroy our society in the last days. Think about it. Here's about all we get today. Books that encourage people to love themselves. Books teaching people to be lovers of money. Books that promote boastful, proud, and abusive behavior. Books that glamorize kids being disobedient to their parents, with ungrateful and unholy attitudes and a mindset that is without love. Books that stimulate unforgiving behavior and slanderous treatment of others. Books that celebrate people without self-control and who are brutal to others. Books that inspire others to not be lovers of good but rather treacherous, rash and conceited. Books that motivate people to be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God and so on and so forth. God says, have nothing to do with them but these elite book publishers are dictating and making sure that's all we get. And you wonder why society is getting so immoral? Junk in equals junk out. They know this. And if you don't believe we're really getting filtered books and print media from the hands of aliens, I mean rich elites, including immoral content, let me share with you just a little more proof of just how blatant these elites are getting with restricting and controlling the narrative we are receiving from books and various print media. They are now moving to the next stage to make sure this brainwashing procedure never stops, believe it or not, by getting us to go along with all this filtering of information. They are now getting a whole new generation to think what they are doing is a good thing. And this is being done first by relabeling what they're doing as not filtering information. No, of course not. It is simply being politically correct. They're not controlling all information and ideas. No. They're helping people not to hurt each other. Isn't that so wonderful? Yeah, I don't think so, because all political correctness is in reality, is a smokescreen, another tricky sophisticated relabeling of what they're doing, that of restricting information, in order to try to make it sound good. But for those of you who may not be familiar with this, let's take a look at political correctness in action.
Meet political correctness, we use this a lot in our culture. So, what is political correctness? Avoiding words or actions that might offend someone. So, that's good, right? It's bad to offend someone. We want to treat people well, and we want to make people feel respected. So, let's look at an example. This guy says, I like gypsies. But this girl says, the term gypsy is offensive. Then the guy says, oh sorry. What is the politically correct term for those people? And the girl says, it's Roma. So, the Roma people are the people group that originated in northern India and migrated to Eastern Europe about 1,000 years ago. Most of them are in Romania, but there is also a large population of them in Italy, Albania, Bulgaria, and a lot of other parts in Europe. They are called Roma. Now, I'm not sure exactly why the word gypsy is offensive. But somehow it is. And those people get offended if we call them gypsies. So, we should learn how they like to be called, and that is Roma. Let's take a look at another example, the word Eskimo. Now, when I was a kid, this word was great. I loved Eskimos. I thought they were so cool because they lived in igloos. A kind of snow house is called an igloo. But then, when I got older, I found out that this term is a bit offensive for them. So, they actually prefer to be called Inuit, not Eskimo. So, remember, if you come to Canada, the people that live in the northern part of Canada are called Inuits. Now there is an American football team called the Washington Redskins. And this is their logo. A circle with an Indian inside. Now who is this guy in the middle of their logo? That is a Native American. Now the term Redskins is a very offensive way to talk about Native Americans. They don't like that, they get offended by it, so if you come to Canada or the US don't use this term Redskins. So, what is the politically correct term to call this people group? Some people use the term Indians in Canada and the US, well actually I'm not sure about the US. If they are called Native American Indians, I'm not sure if that is offensive. But in Canada, the term Indian is derogatory. It's offensive, it's negative. They don't like being called that. Also, I think the word Aboriginals is offensive. I'm not sure, though. I think it is better than Indians. Aborigines, now this word is for all Indigenous people in Australia. They are called Aborigines and I'm not sure if that is offensive or not. Here in Canada, we don't have this word so you might have to look it up on the internet, if this word is offensive or if you have an Australian friend, you can just ask him. What is the politically correct term to use for Indigenous people in your country? Now here in Canada the politically correct term is First Nations. They were here first, they were the Indigenous people here in Canada. If you come to Canada, remember this is the correct term, First Nations. Don't use any of these other terms or Redskins, that is very bad. You know Donald Trump? Everyone knows Donald Trump. So, when Donald Trump called for a ban on Muslims entering the United States, this is a good example of something that is not politically correct. When he said that, everyone said that is really bad, everyone got really offended. They got really angry. Not only Muslims, but he also said Mexicans. He had some not too politically correct words to describe Mexicans, so Mexicans got offended. Muslims got offended, a lot of different people around the world had got offended by Donald Trump. So, he is an example of someone that is not politically correct at all. Political correctness can also have a bad side. It can make people feel afraid to say what they actually think. Like my grandma, for example. She doesn't know the politically correct term for a certain people. She might innocently say the word Indian, she might call the First Nations people Indians. So sometimes politically correctness can bad because a person's intentions are good, but they just don't know. They aren't educated.
And that's the problem. Who educates us on what's politically correct or not? What gives them that right over the rest of us? And whatever happened to free speech, by the way? This is crazy, let alone unconstitutional. I mean, you can call it political correctness all you want, but in reality, all it is a slick relabeling by the elites to ban free speech so they can control it all. That's all it is in a nutshell, folks. You can call it political correctness all you want, you are just simply banning free speech. You are controlling information, ideas, and thoughts. These elites are simply hiding behind this term to simply control the narrative in public, in print, whatever, right down to what you can or cannot say, right share according to them and their agenda. Then they pitch it in a way that makes us think it's all for our good and the good of others, so nobody gets offended. Yeah, right, but at what cost? The cost, again, is simply free speech. And now it is being banned under the guise of political correctness. Very slick and deceptive. And this deceit has been going on for quite some time now. In fact, for so long, that it's now moved on to the second stage of attack on free speech and control of all information, ideas, and thoughts. That is with the new term out there called cancel culture. First, it was political correctness, now it's cancel culture. Stage 1, Stage 2. And in this second stage called cancel culture, they're not only banning or restricting free speech so as not to supposedly offend others. But now they are enforcing this banning of free speech of those who persist in sharing their own free independent ideas or individual thoughts that the elite doesn't want others to receive or goes against their pre-programmed narrative by literally canceling them out of existence altogether from the public arena. Don't believe me? As wild as it sounds, here's just a few examples of this new trend where people's voices being canceled out.
What is cancel culture? Dr. Tina Seeker, lecturer of media and culture, Newcastle University. Cancel culture, I define as an act of public shaming that is based on something that either perceived or substantiated a social transgression of some kind, that hasn't been adequately addressed through traditional channels. So, things like racism, misogyny, ableism, transphobia, there is no way to get any kind of justice for comments that you might find offensive. Celebrities that have done something that people find kind of cringe-worthy and they would sort of as a hyperbolic statement say that they would be cancelled. Then it kind of emanated into the larger conversation, it became involved in identity politics and so-called culture wars. And that usually means that anything that they have produced creatively, it's just not going to be viewed anymore. And there is a little bit of a media blackout. Inside Edition, it's been called one of the greatest films of all times, but in today's times, Gone with the Wind has been pulled from the streaming service HBO Max. Long criticized for its strong video type. Gone with the Wind is gone from HBO. It's one of the most popular films of all times. It's also been condemned for ignoring the horrors of slavery. The streaming service, HBO Max, is now pulling the film. Fox News, where do you draw the line here? I'm told that no longer can you find on HBO Gone with the Wind because somehow that is now somehow offensive. Where do you draw the line? Should George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison be erased from history? What about FDR and the internment camps? Clip from movie The Help, it behooves me to inform you that you are fired, Abilene. The maid is told this, as she is walking into the room with an armful of groceries. Inside Edition, Twitter users today are now calling for Netflix to remove The Help from its lineup, criticizing its white savior narrative. Movies not to watch when trying to educate yourselves on racism, The Help, goes one tweet. Other shows are coming under fire in the wake of the George Floyd protest movement.
After 31 years, Cops has been cancelled over concerns about racial depiction. Luca reports, Gina Carano won't return for the future seasons of the Pedro Pascal-led series The Mandalorian or for any other Star Wars project for that matter. On Wednesday, February 10, 2021, Carano, a former mixed martial artist who has become a recognizable face in the action and sci-fi genres over the years, was fired from The Mandalorian. As reported by Deadline, a spokesperson for Lucasfilm confirmed on Wednesday evening that Carano wasn't just dropped from the first ever live-action Star Wars series, she's also no longer to be considered for or offered employment with Lucasfilm in the future. The decision came after Carano continued to share on social media statements that Lucasfilm deemed, quote, abhorrent. As Deadline details, Carano's most recent controversial post on Instagram suggested that being a Republican in the US in 2021 is similar to being Jewish in Nazi Germany. This sparked outrage online and hashtag #FireGinaCarano started trending on Twitter as folks tagged both Disney and Lucasfilm in thousands of tweets in an effort to remove her from The Mandalorian.
Fox News, cancel culture is claiming a new victim.
Teen Vogue editor Alexi McCammond was forced out just days before starting her new job, after staffers revolted over derogatory tweets she wrote 10 years ago when she was a teenager. Sky News reports, the latest news is the Dr. Seuss books, a whole range of them, are not going to be printed anymore because they offend people. Have you been able to work out what the problem is with If I Ran the Zoo or On Beyond Zebra or Scrambled Eggs? Bella Debrera, director of Western Civilization Program, EPA, the problem is cancel culture on steroids. Cancel culture today is absurd. It's particularly absurd in the US where it is just getting to new levels of extremes. 7.
And unfortunately, it is spreading around the world.
But I agree, this cancel culture mentality and behavior is insidious and absurd and, dare I say, dangerous and flat out an assault on free speech. They make it sound so good and imply it's good for the public so we can all get along, but all it is the strong arm of the political correctness crowd now applied to those who didn't voluntarily stop saying and writing or reporting things that you, the elites, didn't want said or wrote or reported about, i.e., that were politically incorrect. Cancel culture has now become their strong-arm weapon to literally cancel, silence, and permanently remove any voice that goes against their controlled narrative so that the public only gets what they want us to get. Do you see the deception? Keep your glasses on. Because not so surprisingly, this weapon called cancel culture is also being used to encourage scoffing at the things of God, the Bible, and Christianity, just like God warned about when we're living in the last days. Not only are Christian books and the Christian Bible being banned by this cancel culture today, but of course, at the very same time, just about any kind of book that scoffs or promotes scoffing at the Bible and speaks negatively about Christianity is glowingly allowed.
Let me give you just a couple quick examples of that. Will Amazon ban Christian books next?
This continues a string of news stories about Amazon related to books by several authors that have been banned for various political reasons.
Will Christian books be next?
Amazon chose to ban a book on conversion therapy, and it will not be long before they begin to ban Christian books as well.
For Christians, this should be alarming.
A California bill bans the Bible. A California bill is so broad that it bans books, printed materials, and advertisements that provide information that a person facing unwanted same-sex attractions or gender confusion can change. California State Assembly member, Al Muratsuchi, said, "The First Amendment does not prohibit banning fraudulent conduct. The faith community, like anyone else, needs to evolve with the times." During his speech on the California bill at Google headquarters, LGBT activist Samuel Brinton reportedly said he wanted to figure out a way to stop pastors and churches from offering counsel to help people change unwanted same-sex attractions. He went on to say, "I may not be able to find every little camp, every pastor, but I can make it something that is culturally unacceptable." The Bible specifically refers to homosexuality as 1 Corinthians 6:9-11 states, "And such were some of you," thus clearly stating that through a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, people with same-sex attractions or who engaged in same-sex behavior can change. Advertising this passage or quoting it in a brochure would be considered fraudulent business practices under this bill, according to Liberty Counsel.
This bill is an infringement on First Amendment rights and is a classic viewpoint discrimination. It declares certain kinds of speech as consumer fraud.
Matt Staver, founder and chairman of Liberty Counsel, said, "Their goal is to crush Christianity and any viewpoint that does not align with the state."
3 Christian books banned from SRE curriculum in NSW. There has been quite some concern in Christian circles in my home state of NSW over the last few days, over bureaucratic action to ban some books from being used in special religious education classes.
This sudden censorship was, frankly, astonishing. There had been no consultation or discussion on the matter.
In a directive sent to NSW primary and secondary principals overnight, the Department of Education and Communities, the DEC, said, "It has come to the attention of the department that resources being delivered to support special religious education, SRE, in schools may be in conflict with departmental policy and legislative requirements."
No further explanation as to how the books were in conflict with the department's policy was given in the directive.
The DEC instructed all principals to contact SRE providers to ascertain if the books are being used, and to direct providers to cease using them immediately. In a statement to ministers and SRE providers, Mr. Thorpe said, "We would like to remind churches and individuals that all SRE teachers must teach only the authorized curriculum resources." Several SRE teachers and administrators were being approached by school principals to sign a document stating that they have not and will not use the 3 suspended books in their SRE classes.
Michael Jensen says he is perplexed by the decision. "I think this is an outrageous piece of book banning."
And I would agree. But my question is, again, how is this any different than the Fahrenheit 451 premise? How is this any different than what Hitler did with the German people when he literally brainwashed them into thinking that book banning and book burning was good for them? In fact, let's remind ourselves of that dangerous historical event by Hitler.
Peter Black, senior historian, United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. In 1933, the Nationalist Socialist German Workers' Party, called the Nazis for short, came to power in Germany and established a dictatorship under the leadership of Adolf Hitler. The Nazis intended to rearm Germany and reorganize the German state, on the principle that the German ethnic group or race was superior to all others in Europe. They suppressed all dissent within Germany, making it a crime to criticize the regime. The newly established Ministry of Propaganda and Enlightenment set up various chambers to control specific aspects of German culture, such as art, literature, theater, film, music, virtually all forms of entertainment and all forms of dissemination of news. In 1933, in April, Nazi German students decided to organize a nationwide book-burning program to eliminate foreign influence, to purify German culture as they saw it. William F. Meinecke, Jr., historian, United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. "So, you have committees of students meeting with professors together deciding what categories of books in these university libraries would count as un-German. They didn't see themselves as suppressing culture. They saw themselves as advancing Aryan German culture." Robert Beer, Holocaust survivor, born in Berlin, Germany. "I remember very distinctly a conversation between my parents and some friends who were all shocked that a nation like the Germans, an educated, highly intelligent nation, would burn books. Books never hurt anybody." Peter Black. "The event that the students planned occurred on May 10, 1933. In each German university city, 34 of them in all, thousands of people gathered together at a public place in which books that had been confiscated either by the students themselves or by the Nazi Party officials, often with the help of police, were brought and dumped in a pile. Student leaders exhorted their followers and the listening crowds to swear an oath by the fire, to destroy and combat subversive and un-German literature." William Meinecke. "For the national treason against our soldiers in World War I. Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister himself, spoke at the book burning in Berlin. "And the future German man will not just be a man of books, but also a man of character. And it is to this end we want to educate you." Azar Nafisi, author, reading Lolita in Tehran. "It is amazing to me the variety of books that was burned on that night and thereafter." William F. Meinecke. "Among the authors whose books were burned were Ernest Hemingway, both Mann Brothers, Thomas and Heinrich. Erich Maria Remarque, who wrote the famous book All Quiet on the Western Front, Helen Keller, Jack London. Ruth Franklin, literary critic and contributing editor, The New Republic. There is very little that unite them, all these books, except that they were considered dangerous by the Nazis. Peter Black. The grand total of the number of volumes, perhaps best estimates would be between 80 or 90,000 volumes. For weeks afterwards, books were confiscated from libraries, from bookshops, and from private collections. Azar Nafisi. The first thing every totalitarian regime does, along with confiscation and mutilation of reality, is confiscation of history and confiscation of culture. I think they all happen almost simultaneously. Ruth Franklin. Really, all cultures are dangerous to a regime that fears the free flow of ideas. Because the literature in its most fundamental way is meant to forge connections among human beings. Azar Nafisi. Because you don't know where it takes you. Knowledge is always unpredictable, there is always a risk. It is like Alice jumping down that hole, running after that white rabbit, not knowing where she goes. And for tyrants, control is the main thing. They don't like this unpredictability. They don't want the citizens to connect to the unknown parts of themselves, of their past, and to connect to the world. Ruth Franklin. For a totalitarian regime, this is perhaps the most dangerous thing. Because these regimes are predicated on the idea that the people within them will resign themselves to thinking that this is all there is. And that there aren't any options. Robert Beer. How serious those warning signs were taken is exemplified by my mother, who, when I asked her if we had to worry about a guy like Hitler, she said, "No, we are living in a democracy. We have the protection of the police. Nobody's going to hurt us." So, talk about warning signs, there were plenty of them. Did we take them seriously? My family didn't. Peter Black. In 1939, the Nazi regime initiated what became the Second World War. During the course of this war, the Nazis began to implement their population policy, a priority element of which was the annihilation of 6 million Jews on the European continent, in a mass murder or genocide that we now call the Holocaust. Robert Beer. We never believed the Germans would stoop so low that they would implement the threats which one fanatic uttered. And so, our own life went from bad to worse, and it culminated in July of 1942, when we were arrested and sent to a concentration camp. To make this clear, it was a life without hope. Where books are burned, in the end people will be burned. Heinrich Heine, 1821 German poet.
And that is exactly what happened. Folks, we better wake up and get our head out of the sand. History is repeating itself. Except this time, it is on a much grander scale. All they have done is change the terminology. Book burning, book banning, political correctness, cancel culture, whatever you want to call it, it is all the same things. Only this time, it is not just happening in Germany by one totalitarian dictator called Hitler. Now it is spreading across the globe, and it's being done by a handful of aliens, I mean rich elites. But the premise is still the same. It's the beginning of a global dictatorship in which anyone who resists them or gets in their way of what they deem to be or desire as truth will eventually be taken out. First you burn the books, then you burn the people. When will we ever learn? But hey, good thing the youth today and younger generations aren't falling for this book-burning cancel culture mentality like Hitler did with the youth of his day. Oh, how I wish that were true. Unfortunately, these same elites and all their media brainwashing techniques have worked all too well on a whole new up-and-coming young generation that has actually been convinced that the destruction and deletion of any and all dissenting ideas or independent thoughts other than their own is actually a good thing. Including going to the point of literally burning books they disagree with and think others should not read, just like the youth did back in Hitler's days, only it's today. Watch this.
11alive.com. A meeting is going on right now at the Georgia Southern over book burning. It comes after students burned a Latina author's book after she visited the school last week. Those students are going to be disciplined for this.
What you just saw, in my opinion, was a modern-day Hitler youth movement taking place. Now, we don't call them Hitler youth today, of course not. Why, haven't you heard? That is a politically incorrect statement. You cannot say that today, it might offend somebody. And whatever you do, don't say it's book burning. No. 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 They are part of a whole new cancel culture movement that's only trying to help people not offend or hurt others. Yeah, right. What a modern day deception. All they're doing is twisting their words in order to silence other people's words. It's Fahrenheit 451 becoming our reality. Hitler would have loved this movement. And the reason why is because it has been able to do what he wasn't able to do, that is, go beyond just one country and spread this book-burning information and thought control movement across the planet. So, the next obvious question is, how in the world did this happen? How did our nation turn so quickly from valuing the rights of free speech to the actual restricting and canceling of free speech? How did this mindset of a whole new generation arise on the scene where people not only accept but actually promote the idea that we need to let these elites control all books, print media, and overall information or thought for our own supposed good? Well, they simply did it by controlling the whole education system, just like you saw in that new Fahrenheit 451 trailer. It's almost like somebody's following a script. Believe it or not, they admit this is precisely where the brainwashing needs to start. The education system. You need to get them while they're young, like Hitler did. And if these same elites who are controlling and filtering all the books and print media, and all the other forms of media like newspapers, radio and music as we saw, could also somehow grab control of the whole educational system, then that means they could even brainwash a whole new generation into thinking that what they're doing is actually a good thing instead of a bad thing, and even get us to go along with it. And that's precisely what they've done. Don't believe me? These manipulated byproducts of the educational system today, who go along with the elite's agenda to restrict and eliminate free speech, let alone any dissenting idea, are not just real, but they have even been given a new name. Again, we don't call them Hitler Youth, that's not politically correct. Have you already forgotten? Rather, we call them snowflakes. You know, those young people are so-called modern education system that is pumping out by the boatloads, young impressionable minds that can no longer tolerate or handle any disagreeing opinion other than their own which has been shaped by the elites and then demands the government to forbid, ban or cancel out any other views. You can actually see them in action here. Here's what your taxpayer dollars are producing in our modern education system.
Narrator, thanks to major advances in technology, we now have access to tools that allow us to zoom in and listen to the sound of an actual snowflake falling towards the earth, preparing itself to experience a reality that is different from its own. Observe carefully and witness this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for yourself. Sitting in a crowd, listening for the 2020 election results, there is a snowflake. When it is announced that Donald Trump won the election, the snowflake opens its mouth to let out a blood-curdling scream at the disappointment. Not one time did it scream, but over and over. The disappointment was just too much for it to handle. Tucker Carlson, college students seem to get stressed out by finals, but if they are attending the University of Utah, you have an option. It's called the Cry Closet. The Cry Closet is the creation of an art student named Nemo Miller, and it exists for stressed-out students. You can step into it for up to 10 minutes for crying to help cope with the tests. The closet interior consists of fuzzy stuffed animals for maximum coping.
What has happened to our country? You don't like somebody else's decisions or ideas or opinions, so you fall on the ground and scream your lungs out in utter despair and cry like a big baby? And yet, you are supposed to be an adult. And not only that, but you also literally can't handle any kind of stress, to the point where you need a cry closet full of stuffed animals to help you cope with life? What has happened to us? What a bunch of wimps. But folks, as crazy as this all sounds, and as unbelievable as this behavior is, it's not by chance. It's deliberately being done to them. This whole new politically correct, cancel culture, book-burning generation called snowflakes, are simply the byproduct of the whole new modern education system that's been hijacked by these same aliens, I mean rich elites who have not only taken over the various forms of media around the world as we saw with the newspapers, radio, music, and books, but they have also simultaneously taken over the whole education system to brainwash a whole new generation into accepting their total global control of all information we receive in order to manipulate us according to their nefarious global agenda. And as wild and conspiratorial as that sounds, let's now begin to take a look at how that actual takeover happened. And as we do, let's first go back and take a look how our educational system used to be before it got hijacked by these aliens, I mean rich elites.
The first colleges formed in America, 123 out of 126, were formed on Christian principles. Up until 1900, it was very rare to find a university president who was not an ordained clergyman. The New England Primer, America's first textbook and used for 210 years, taught the alphabet like this: A in Adam's fall we sinned all. C. Christ crucified for sinners died. Z. Zacchaeus he did climb the tree our Lord to see. The 107 questions at the end of the New England Primer included questions like, what offices does Christ execute as our Redeemer? How does Christ execute the office of a priest? What is required in the fifth commandment? What are the benefits which in this life do accompany or flow from justification, adoption, and sanctification? George Washington made it crystal clear that American schools would teach Indian youths the religion of Jesus Christ, and Congress assisted in doing so. In 1782, Congress had 10,000 Bibles printed for use in schools. Dr. Benjamin Rush said, "The only means of establishing and perpetuating our republican forms of government is the universal education of our youth in the principles of Christianity by means of the Bible." Thomas Jefferson wrote the first plan of education for the city of Washington, D.C. and adopted two textbooks, the Bible and Watts Hymnal, and hired clergymen to be the teachers. The 1854 edition of Webster's Dictionary had biblical definitions, Bible verses, and Webster's own testimony of personally receiving Christ. America's first school was Harvard, founded in 1636 by Reverend John Harvard, whose official motto was For Christ and the Church. Harvard had several requirements which students had to observe, one of which was, let every scholar be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well, the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life. Boy, that's not what we have in schools today, is it? Not even close. In fact, wait until you hear where the largest church in America used to be. Watch this. David Barton, tour guide at the Capitol. This is a copy of what the first Bible printed in English in America looked like. This Bible was printed by the U.S. Congress in 1782. In the record it says that this Bible was an approach to the Holy Scriptures for the use of our schools. So, the first Bible, printed in English, in America, was printed by Congress, for the use of our schools. It's worse than that. On the front of the cover, it says that Congress resolved that the United States and Congress recommend this edition of the Bible for its inhabitants in the United States. So, the first Bible, printed in English, in America, was done by the guys that signed the documents, endorsed by Congress, and done for use in schools, and we are going to be told that they don't want any kind of religion in education, they don't want voluntary prayer, no. It doesn't make sense. This document by itself is very significant. In 1830, Congress commissioned these four paintings over here to recapture what the official record says was the Christian history of the United States. In these four paintings, you have a span of several hundred years. By taking you through chronologically, the first is Columbus landing in the Western world in 1492. They got out, they knelt down and had a prayer service. Do you see the cross they had? They named the land where they had landed, San Salvador, meaning Holy Savior, which tells you something of the thinking that was going on then. You come back. Over my shoulder, here this is the baptism of Pocahontas in Jamestown was in 1613. Over here, the fourth painting is in 1620. This is the embarkation of the pilgrims coming to America. You see them gathered around the Bible at the prayer meeting they are having. If you just take those four paintings there, those four paintings, in this great secular hall of government, represent two prayer meetings, a Bible study, and a baptism, which is not bad for a secular building. As a matter of fact, you are standing in a what, in 1857, was the largest church in the United States. The U.S. Capitol. Back on December 4th in 1800, members of Congress, members of the Senate, Thomas Jefferson was over the Senate, John Trumbull on the House, they decided to turn this Capitol building into a church building. Starting on Sunday, they started having services in the Capitol. 6 weeks after that, Thomas Jefferson became President of the United States. During his 8 years of being president, he came to church here at the U.S. Capitol, listened to the services here at the Capitol, and being Commander-in-Chief, he decided he could help to worship here at the Capitol. He ordered the Marine Corps Band to come play at the worship service. Now that would be rather cool to have the Marine Corps Band play the music at the worship service. That church went on for the better part of the century, and by 1857 there were 2,000 people went to church in the hall of the House of Representatives. In addition to that, there were four other churches that met at the Capitol. First Congregational, this was their church home, as was First Presbyterian, as was Capitol Hill Presbyterian. Churches met here. There was nothing secular or seemed to be secular about this building until the last 30, 40, 50 years.
Until it got hijacked by the elites, as we will soon see. But wow, they don't tell you that interesting piece of American history in the media or school system today, do they? Not at all. I wonder why? Well, we'll find out here in a second. But if you want even more proof that our founding fathers wanted the Bible and God's principles to be integrated and taught in our education system, let me give you just a few more quotes from them.
John Adams. The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Without religion, this world would be something not fit to be mentioned in polite company, I mean hell. The Christian religion is, above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. John Quincy Adams. My hopes of a future life are all founded upon the gospel of Christ. In the chain of human events, the birthday of the nation is indissolubly linked with the birthday of the Savior. The Declaration of Independence laid the cornerstone of human government upon the first precepts of Christianity. Patrick Henry. Being a Christian is a character which I prize far above all this world has or can boast. Righteousness alone can exalt America as a nation. The great pillars of all government and of social life are virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone, that renders us invincible. John Jay. Original Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Mercy and grace and favor did come by Jesus Christ. By conveying the Bible to people, we certainly do them a most interesting act of kindness. The most effectual means of securing the continuance of our civil and religious liberties is always to remember with reverence and gratitude the source from which they flow. The Bible is the best of all books, for it is the Word of God and teaches us the way to be happy in this world and in the next. Continue therefore to read it and to regulate your life by its precepts. Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. Benjamin Rush. Father of public schools under the Constitution. The gospel of Jesus Christ prescribes the wisest rules for just conduct in every situation of life. Happy they who are enabled to obey them in all situations. The great enemy of the salvation of man, Satan, in my opinion, never invented a more effective means of limiting Christianity from the world than by persuading mankind that it was improper to read the Bible at schools. Christianity is the only true and perfect religion, and in proportion as mankind adopt its principles and obey its precepts, they will be wise and happy. The Bible should be read in our schools in preference to all other books. Noah Webster, Schoolmaster to America. The religion which has introduced civil liberty is the religion of Christ and his apostles. This is genuine Christianity, and to this we owe our free constitutions of government. The moral principles and precepts found in the scriptures ought to form the basis of all our civil constitutions and laws. I am persuaded that no civil government of a republican form can exist and be durable in which the principles of Christianity have not a controlling influence. George Washington. You do well to wish to learn our arts and ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are. While we are zealously performing the duties of good citizens and soldiers, we certainly ought not to be inattentive to the higher duties of religion. To the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian. Congress, U.S. House Judiciary Committee, 1854. Had the people, during the Revolution, had a suspicion of any attempt to war against Christianity, that revolution would have been strangled in its cradle. In this age, there can be no substitute for Christianity. That was the religion of the founders of the Republic, and they expected it to remain the religion of their descendants.
Sounds to me like the founding fathers of America clearly wanted, planned, and even provided for the Bible and God's principles to be taught in our education system and to be promoted throughout our country. In fact, we even had presidents who did these kinds of godly biblical things while they were still in office. Check this out.
David Barton, tour guide at the Capitol. Do you see that statue to the left of the door over there, that white marble statue? That is President James A. Garfield. President Garfield was one of the young major generals in the Civil War. He was a war hero. He became Speaker of the House, he became the 20th President of the United States, and by the way, That man founded Howard University. General Howard took it over after he founded it. Just a really cool guy. But what we never hear about that President of the United States is that he was a minister during the Second Great Awakening. This is actually one of his letters signed, James A. Garfield, 1858, and in this letter President Garfield recounts that he had just finished preaching a revival service where he had preached the gospel 19 times in the revival. He said as a result of his preaching, 34 folks came to Christ, and he baptized 31 of them. Now that doesn't sound like a typical presidential activity today, but that is what we used to do with presidents in the past. Again, you can walk through and see that statue and say there's a president, but you would never think that there is a minister. We have so compartmentalized Christianity into such a small box that we don't realize that our military leaders, our ministers, our educators, our presidents, used to be ministers. I would say about 1/4 of these statues are ministers of the gospel.
Wow. Why don't they share that in our education system today? Well, again, we'll get to that in a second, but let's first answer the obvious question. Why were the founding fathers so adamant on making sure we had the biblical teachings and Christianity and God's holy principles taught in our education system? Because 1, they wanted the people to know clearly where our rights and freedoms as Americans came from. They come from God, not the government. This is what our country was built upon. I didn't say that they did, it's in the Declaration of Independence.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Secondly, our founding fathers made sure that the Bible and Christianity and God's principles were woven into our education system not only so people would know where our rights and freedoms come from, that is God, our Creator, not the government, but also to keep our hearts in check morally so we would not get tricked into going back to a tyrannical form of government. You see, the founding fathers knew that the Bill of Rights and Constitution were only an outward shell that could only provide general direction for the government. But they could not tame the internal heart of man, to keep him under control morally. The taming of the heart, they believed, was up to the Bible. That's why they wanted to ensure that the Bible was taught throughout our education system. They knew that if America's heart got inwardly rotten again morally, then the Bill of Rights and Constitution could not stop us as a people from going backwards again, back to tyranny and oppression that the founding fathers escaped from back in England. So, they wanted to make sure that all people in America could and would study the Bible to stay morally in check to prevent us from going back to tyranny. But look at us today. We are no longer taught these facts about the true intentions of our founding fathers of having the Bible, Christian teachings, and godly principles permeating throughout the education system for stated reasons, but now we have an education system that says the exact polar opposite. That there is no Creator, and that our rights come from the government, not from God, and that even our Constitution, which was built on biblical principles of freedom, is actually now a dangerous document. In other words, it's not politically correct today. Don't believe me? Recently, a publishing company actually put a warning label on the Constitution. And I quote, "Wilder Publications warns readers of its reprints of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, Common Sense, the Articles of Confederation, and the Federalist Papers, among others, that this book is a product of its time and does not reflect the same values as it would if it were written today." The disclaimer goes on to tell parents that they might wish to discuss with their children how views on race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and interpersonal relations have changed since this book was written. Excuse me? A warning label on the Constitution of the United States of America? Folks, that's not only ludicrous, but it's also blasphemous to the original intent of our founding fathers. And then on top of that, we even have the long-standing devious lie that's also spread throughout the minds of the American people, and that is the lie that our founding fathers did not want the Bible or Christian teachings, or God's principles taught in our schools. No. They say, rather, our founding fathers wanted separation of church and state, which basically has come to mean today, keep God, Christianity, and the Bible out of our education system, and our lives, at all costs. Now again, this is not only ludicrous, as we saw based on the actual historical statements made by our founding fathers, but not so surprisingly, This lie is simply the twisting of a historical phrase by another one of our founding fathers, that of Thomas Jefferson. The next time someone spouts off the phrase, separation of church and state, and they say that phrase proves that our founding fathers wanted to get rid of Christianity, and the Bible and God's principles, you need to challenge them. Ask them this. Where does that phrase, separation of church and state, appear in the Bill of Rights? Where does it appear in the Constitution? Answer? It's not there in either one of them. Rather, it came from a letter from Thomas Jefferson in 1802 to the Danbury Baptists of Connecticut, who were concerned that another popular Christian denomination at that time called the Congregationalists were going to become the official Christian denomination of the United States. Now, notice the whole time the context is Christians and Christianity. Not the exclusion of it, let alone the acceptance and promotion of Buddhism, Islam, Eastern mysticism, and everything else under the sun. No. When our founding fathers talked about religion, they were talking about Christianity. And so, in that letter, Jefferson simply referred the Danbury Baptists and their concern back to the First Amendment that reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, he had full confidence in the original intent of the First Amendment that it would ensure that no Christian denomination would be chosen to be the official Christian denomination of the United States. That's it. That's what he meant by the phrase, separation of church and state. And again, it did not have anything to do with keeping Christianity, God, and the Bible and Christian teachings out of our education system or society today. We know that not only by the historical context of that letter from Jefferson, but again, also from the very words of our founding fathers that clearly stated they wanted to keep the Bible, Christian teachings, and God's principles in our schools and society for all time. And so, the next common sense question is, how in the world did this happen? How did our nation that was built upon biblical principles of freedom, and our rights that come from God, get so twisted around that we actually now forbid the Bible in our whole education system? Well, again, it's been hijacked by a group aliens, I mean rich elites, who are using the education system to promote humanism in order to take us back to a tyrannical form of government to control us. And for those of you who may not know what humanism is, it's the worldview where man is basically the center of all things, not God. And so right out of the gates, you can see this belief system is diametrically opposed to the biblical teachings that God is the center of all things, and as our founding fathers believed, our rights come from Him, the Creator, not man. So, these elites' first step was to twist this protective biblical belief on its head in order to brainwash the American people into going back to tyranny by conditioning them to think our rights came from man or the government, not God. And they did it with the education system. But don't just take my word for it, let's listen to theirs. Let's take a look at their own humanist beliefs from the Humanist Manifesto 1 and 2, and let's see if their man-centered anti-biblical belief system is being taught in our educational system today.
Faith in the prayer-hearing God, assumed to live and care for persons, to hear and understand their prayers, and to be able to do something about them, is an unproved and outmoded faith.
We find insufficient evidence for the belief in the existence of a supernatural. We begin with humans, not God. We do not accept as true the literal interpretation of the Old and New Testaments. We include a recognition of an individual's right to die with dignity, euthanasia, suicide, birth control, and abortion. We believe that intolerant attitudes, often cultivated by orthodox religions and puritanical cultures, unduly repress sexual conduct. Divorce should be recognized. The many varieties of sexual exploration should not themselves be considered evil. We oppose any tyranny over the mind of man to shackle free thought. In the past, such tyrannies have been directed by churches and states attempting to enforce the edicts of religious bigots. Promises of immortal salvation or fear of eternal damnation are both illusory and harmful. Salvationism, based on mere affirmation, still appears as harmful, diverting people with false hopes of heaven hereafter. No deity will save us, we must save ourselves.
As you can see, all those humanist beliefs, every single one of them, are now being taught throughout our education system today, instead of the biblical teachings that our founding fathers wanted. And lest you doubt, they've hijacked the schools to promote this lie. It was none other than John Dewey, the man who is considered to be the father of our so-called modern educational system, who not only was an original signer of the Humanist Manifesto and celebrated today and given high honors by the NEA, or the National Education Association, but he is the one who wrote the theory of education we use today in our schools based on evolution and humanism. And from there, these same humanists went on the attack and forced the Bible, prayer, and even the Ten Commandments to be removed from our school system, courtrooms, and governmental institutions under the guise that religion and education do not mix. You know, the lie of separation of church and state. And yet, humanism itself was declared as a religion by the Supreme Court back in the early 60s. And can you guess whose religion is being taught in schools today? That's right, humanism. Anybody seeing the irony here? So why would these humanists want to take over the educational system, courtrooms, and government, with their anti-God teachings? Because again, they're taking over the hearts and minds of the America people for control. They're mesmerizing the minds of the masses to take us back to tyranny. Again, our country was built upon the biblical teachings that our rights and freedoms come from God, not the government. And as long as we continue to be educated into these biblical truths that we Americans hold self-evident as stated by our founding fathers, then we will always be protected from going back to a tyrannical form of government. Therefore, if someone is ever going to trick us into going back to tyranny, then the first thing they have to do is remove the biblical protection. That's why these elites are today re-educating and mesmerizing the minds of the American people away from the Bible, Christian teachings, and God's principles in the education system and supplanting it with atheism, humanism, and an evolutionary worldview that says our rights come from man, not God. And that's not just what they've done, as we clearly saw tracing the trail of historical evidence, but believe it or not, they even admit that this was their plan from the very beginning. They wanted to hijack the American school system in order to mesmerize the minds of the masses or the American people, into humanism, man-centered teaching, and away from God. Don't believe me? Here are their own words admitting it.
Our great object was to get rid of Christianity and to convert our churches into halls of science. The plan was not to make open attacks on religion, but to establish a system of state schools, from which all religion was to be excluded, and to which all parents were to be compelled by law to send their children. For this purpose, a secret society was formed, and the whole country was to be organized. Orestes Brownson, 1803-1876. What the church has been for medieval man, the public school must become for democratic and rational man. God would be replaced by the concept of the public good. Horace Mann, 1796-1858. There is no God and there is no soul. Hence, there is no need for the props of traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed, natural law or moral absolutes. John Dewey, 1859-1952, the father of progressive education, co-author of the first Humanist Manifesto and honorary NEA president. Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every American school is a school of humanism. What can a theistic Sunday school's meeting for an hour once a week and teaching only a fraction of the children do to stem the tide of the five-day program of humanistic teaching? Charles F. Potter, Humanism, A New Religion, 1930. I think that the most important factor moving us toward a secular society has been the educational factor. Our schools may not teach Johnny to read properly, but the fact that Johnny is in school until he is 16 tends to lead toward the elimination of religious superstition. Paul Blanchard, Three Cheers for Our Secular State, The Humanist, March/April 1976. We must ask how we can kill the God of Christianity. We need only to ensure that our schools teach only secular knowledge. If we could achieve this, God would indeed be shortly due for a funeral service. G. Richard Bosworth, On Keeping God Alive, American Atheist, November 1977. I'm convinced that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the public school classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity. These teachers must embody the same selfless dedication as the most rabid fundamentalist preachers, for they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing a classroom instead of a pulpit to convey humanist values in whatever subject they teach, regardless of educational level, preschool, daycare, or a large state university. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity, and the new faith of humanism. John J. Dunphy, A New Religion for a New Age, The Humanist, January/February 1983. Every child in America entering school at the age of 5 is mentally ill, because he comes to school with certain allegiances toward our founding fathers, toward our elected officials, toward his parents, toward a belief in a supernatural being, toward the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. It is up to you teachers to make all these sick children well by creating the international children of the future. Harvard professor of education and psychiatry, 1984.
How can you get any clearer than that? Schools and the educational system are the means of which these elites will use to brainwash a whole new generation of Americans into humanism and away from God in order to trick us into going back into a tyrannical form of government, where man or these aliens, I mean rich elites, will dictate our very rights and freedoms and free speech and beliefs and even behavior, not God. And unfortunately, their plan has worked all too well because, as we saw, these new international children of the future have been created via the education system, known as snowflakes. They really believe that man or the government should dictate every facet of our lives and even punish or ban or cancel out anyone who disagrees with that. Isn't that wild? That's not freedom, it's slavery. Our founding fathers must be rolling over in their graves. But as you can see by their own words, humanists admit they hijacked our education system with their man-centered belief system and are now using the schools to turn kids away from God and the biblical principles of freedom in order to brainwash and indoctrinate them in humanism so these elites can rule over us. In fact, if you want even more proof that the schools are doing this to the minds of a whole new young generation of impressionable children, here's one lady who used to work for them, but now she's blowing the whistle on them. She admits, they not only don't want to teach your kid about education, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, but to indoctrinate them into a humanist mindset against God and biblical principles of freedom. Watch this.
Charlotte Iserbite, my name is Charlotte Iserbite, and I served as senior policy advisor in the United States Department of Education under the Reagan administration, during which I had access to all the most important documents for the restructuring for not only the American education but for the global education. I am also the author of The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, which gets into all of this, into the background of what I saw not only in the Department of Education but as a local school board member. Just to give you an idea of how blatant they are, Benjamin Bloom said the purpose of education and often says parents really listen to us. You think the real purpose of education is reading, writing, and arithmetic? The purpose of education is to change the thoughts, actions, and feelings of students. And then he goes on and he says he defines good teaching, and this is even worse from the parental standpoint, as challenging the students' fixed beliefs. And then in some of his works that I have, it's all in my book, say he can take a student, it's through challenging, you go up against them and you change them. Then he goes on in one part of the taxonomy that is in my book, he says he can take a student from here to there, from a belief in God or his country, whatever, to being an atheist and not believing in his country in 1 hour. Oh yes, he does. I've seen it with young people.
Wow. Talk about shades of Hitler. So much for reading, writing, and arithmetic. That's not education, that's indoctrination. That's brainwashing. They admit they're using the whole education system to brainwash kids away from God and biblical principles into humanism and atheism. And they can do it in 1 hour. Why? Because that's the first step into tricking a free people of a free nation into going back to slavery and tyranny. And as she noted, this wasn't just going on in America, but what? Internationally. In all the schools across the globe. And if you want further proof of that global invasion, then look no further than who controls all the content of all the books that are being used to educate, or should we say indoctrinate or brainwash kids around the whole planet. Just like we saw with secular book publishers, the publishers of textbooks used in schools today also call themselves the Big Five.
Number 1 McGraw-Hill Education, annual revenue, $1.7 billion. Notable imprints, Glencoe/McGraw-Hill, Macmillan/McGraw-Hill, McGraw-Hill Higher Education, new editions of test prep books, SAT and ACT, and elementary school math textbooks. McGraw-Hill Education should ring a bell for anyone who's experienced the magic of the American public school system. As one of the Big Five educational publishers, McGraw-Hill has long played a major part in providing textbooks and other curriculum materials for the K-12 set. And while much of its current strategy focuses on digital content and technological learning solutions, it still has a serious horse in the race of textbook publishing. Number 2 Scholastic. Annual revenue, $1.7 billion. Notable imprints, Arthur A. Levine, Klutz Press, Orchard Books. Another major publisher of educational texts as well as kids' books, Scholastic was founded in 1920 and has remained relatively intact, that is, unlike many other publishers. No one else owns it. Scholastic is the largest publisher and distributor of children's books in the world, with perpetual rights to many of the most famous children's and YA series of all time, such as Harry Potter, recently acquired from Bloomsbury, and The Hunger Games. Its annual revenue has averaged around $2 billion over the past couple of years, and it consistently publishes some of the most popular titles in children's literature. Number 3. Cengage Learning. Annual revenue, $1.5 billion. Notable imprints, Chilton, Education to Go, Gale, National Geographic Learning. Cengage is an educational publisher that's on the rise, especially after its most recent fiscal report. Cengage's profits last year came largely from online textbooks and other course materials, similar to McGraw-Hill. However, despite its present business model being digitally based, Cengage is still linked to traditional publishing in the form of a library division called Gale. Between the research and academic publishing that Gale conducts and the thorough online resources that Cengage supplies, we can expect to see Cengage rise in these rankings over time. Number 4. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Annual revenue, $1.4 billion. Notable imprints, Clarion, Graphia, John Joseph Adams Books, Sandpiper, elementary school textbooks in all subjects. Officially formed in 2007 after a merger between, you guessed it, Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is the second of the Big Five educational publishers. Though it was formerly a subsidiary of Education Media and Publishing Group, HMH now owns itself and all its imprints, which include Holt McDougall and Riverside Publishing. Like McGraw-Hill and Cengage, HMH serves the K-12 education market and sees most of its profits from that. Number 5. Pearson Education. Annual revenue, $1 billion. Notable imprints, Adobe Press, Heinemann, Prentice Hall, Wharton Publishing. Pearson PLC was once a part owner of Penguin Random House, but its Pearson Education division is limited to academic texts. This is the third of the Big Five educational publishers and, similar to its fellows, Pearson Education has made great digital strides to stay at the top of the market over recent years. PE has recently partnered up with language learning service Duolingo to reach more consumers, and it's also established a website-operated textbook rental service. Indeed, like other educational publishers, textbooks remain a cornerstone of its business.
And so, as you can see, as handful of aliens I mean rich elites own and control all the textbooks for the education of the whole planet, just like they control all the regular books on the planet. Anybody seeing a pattern here? And if you want even more proof that this is being done on a global scale, then consider this next thread of historical evidence about of our education system. It's being dictated by the United Nations and the elites. The education plan designed by the elites to brainwash the whole planet is simply called the World Core Curriculum. George Bush Sr. brought it into our education system and simply renamed it America 2000. Then, it was picked up by Bill Clinton and renamed Goals 2000. Why did he call it Goals 2000? Because the goal was to get this world curriculum implemented into the American schools by the year 2000. It was all coming from the United Nations and the elites. Then it transferred hands from Bill Clinton to George Bush Jr., who simply changed the name to No Child Left Behind. And then the same deceptive relabeling technique continued on with Obama, and he called this global brainwashing curriculum for the planet, Common Core. But it is all the same thing. Now you know why our kids and society have been getting dumbed down more and more and are clueless about our true history, including the beliefs of our founding fathers and where our rights and freedoms truly come from. God, not the government. It's being done on purpose. These aliens, I mean rich elites, have hijacked and now totally control our education system and are using it to prepare kids, literally brainwash them, and mesmerize their minds into thinking what the elites want them to think in order to enslave them and the whole planet into accepting and going along with and even promoting their nefarious agenda. Pretty slick, isn't it? And speaking of deception taught in schools today, you might be thinking, like a good little snowflake, well, there's nothing wrong with having humanism, atheism, evolution, and different views of origin taught in our education system today. I mean, kids can make up their own minds based on the facts, right, what's right or not. Isn't that what schools are all about? Teaching kids to be critical thinkers? Well, it used to be, but not anymore. Now our so-called modern school system exists not to teach kids to be critical thinkers, but rather what to think. That's not education, that's indoctrination. And they're doing that by forcing students to have only one view of origins in schools, that of atheism, humanism, evolutionary ideals, and purposely excluding all mentioning of the biblical view of origins that our founding father believed in and wanted for the American people to teach us that our rights and freedoms come from God our Creator, not man. By the way, if you want more facts about how humanism, atheism and evolution is a lie, then get our study entitled, The Witness of Creation, so you can get equipped with the facts that demonstrate clearly just how bankrupt, untrue, and even unscientific these belief systems really are. But again, this is the hypocritical behavior of our education system today. The irony is the whole initial original argument from these humanists to get their man-centered atheist teachings, including evolution, into our schools was that it was unfair to have just one view of origins taught in our education system. This was their original argument during the Scopes monkey trial, as seen here.
Until the 1990s, no trial in American history attracted more attention than this one did, that is, the Scopes monkey trial. It was held in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, and it accused a teacher of violating a state law that banned the teaching of human evolution. Although the teacher had not taught biology and could not even remember for sure whether he had discussed evolution while substituting for the regular teacher, he agreed to be arrested and stand trial anyway. For the contest, the ACLU brought in several big city attorneys, including the famed criminal lawyer and atheist Clarence Darrow from Chicago. And to assist the prosecution, the World's Christian Fundamentals Association secured the services of William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska, a 3-time candidate for president and anti-evolutionist. It was until this trial that most public schools taught the divine creation theory. Students in those days studied the facts of science and were told that the evidence indicates there is a creator who designed the universe and plants and animals. But that was soon to change. The trial lasted 8 days and, as expected, it ended in a conviction for the young teacher, whose own attorneys even conceded his guilt. However, in that famous trial, atheist lawyer Clarence Darrow said, "It is bigotry to only teach one view of origin." He said, "Students should be taught both the creation and evolution theories." So, in the 35 years following that trial, the theory of evolution was not only taught more and more, but it was being presented as if it were a proven scientific fact. Until today, we actually have this trial in reverse. Evolution is now the only theory that is taught.
Gee, that sounds hypocritical. But what most of us also don't realize about the Scopes monkey trial is that it seemed to be a watershed event that forever changed our nation for the worse. And that's because even though evolutionists lost that famous case, a momentum for evolutionary teachings began to take a foothold in our education system. And so, over the next 35 years, the theory of evolution began to be taught more and more in our schools. Until finally, in the early 60s, prayer and Bible reading were eventually taken out and evolution was put permanently in. And to help the American people to buy into these lies that were introduced in our education in order to brainwash us away from God and the knowledge of where our rights and freedoms come from. Hollywood, another form of media that we'll get into next, began to mesmerize the minds of the masses into thinking this Scopes monkey trial was a good liberating thing for the American public. They did this with a movie called Inherit the Wind. But the problem is, once again, these now Hollywood humanists lied to advance their freedom-killing agenda. Let's take a look at that deception.
A clip from Inherit the Wind. In a courtroom scene, Spencer Tracy is speaking. "Darwin took us forward to a hilltop from where we could look back to see the way of which we came. For this insight and for this knowledge we must abandon our faith in the pleasant poetry of Genesis." Narrator. One of the most enduring films of its era, Inherit the Wind has been universally hailed as a brilliant recreation of a fascinating episode in American history. Popular reviewer Leonard Maltin called it an absorbing drama and based on the notorious Scopes monkey trial of 1925. And then went on to say the issue is real and still relevant. The issue, of course, is evolution. And undergirding it is the classic struggle between religion and rationalism. Whether God's word or the suppositions of science should provide the foundation upon which men and women order their lives. Had Inherit the Wind been faithful to the facts concerning this, quote, fascinating episode in American history, end quote, Hollywood would be immune to the charges of bias on this important issue. The truth is, however, that the drama played out on the big screen bore little resemblance to the actual trial. Consider just a few of the film's many distortions and the bias they reveal. The movie opens with a rather ominous rendition of the song, Old Time Religion. As drums pound, sinister-looking men begin to gather together. The focus of their dark conspiracy is revealed as they enter the local high school and burst into a science class. There, John Scopes is found passionately teaching evolution to his eager students. Teacher John Scopes: We are finished with our lesson for today. We will continue our discussion of Darwin's theory of the descent of man. Narrator: He is promptly thrown into jail, where he remains throughout the course of the trial. Help then arrives in the persons of two smart, tough-talking agnostics, writer H.L. Mencken and trial lawyer Clarence Darrow, played by Spencer Tracy. Scopes is for the moment saved from the fundamentalist Christians who gather outside his jail to throw things and breathe threats of a lynching. In reality, John Scopes' classroom was never invaded. His arrest was a sham perpetrated by pro-evolution forces, and he never spent a moment in jail. A math teacher and football coach, Scopes had spent 2 weeks substitute teaching in a biology class where he simply helped students review for a final exam. The trial came about as a result of the ACLU's desire to test a state law forbidding not the teaching of evolution, per se, but only the theory that man had descended from lower animals. Scopes reluctantly volunteered to be their guinea pig and in return had his tuition covered for graduate school. As for the mean-spiritedness and hypocrisy of a Bible-believing townfolk, a theme the film pounds home time and again, visiting reporters in fact noted the kindness and extreme courtesy of the town's citizens. Clarence Darrow himself observed that he had been treated better, kindlier and more hospitably than I fancy would have been the case in the North. Perhaps even more dishonest than these distortions of historical records is the film's portrayal of the renowned lawyer and three-time nominee for President William Jennings Bryan, as the prosecutor in this case. It fell to Bryan to defend the biblical account of man's origins. The film uses the epic courtroom battle between Bryan and Darrow as a dramatic device to illustrate the struggle between faith and suppositional science. Guess who's made to look like an idiot? Bryan. The Bible is enough to satisfy me. It is enough. Darrow. It frightens me to think of the state of learning in the world if everybody had your driving curiosity. Narrator. Throughout the film, Bryan is portrayed as a stupid, close-minded, hypocritical egotist. One minute he's shown cruelly intimidating Scopes' fiancée on the witness stand. The next, using legal pretense to block scientific testimony he fears will destroy his case. Bryan. I refuse to go along with these agnostic scientists to employ this courtroom as a sounding board. There's a platform from which they shout their heresies into the headline. Narrator. He's portrayed as blindly intolerant when he states his opposition to the use of Darwin's book in public schools and then admits he's never read it. Bryan. I am not the least interested in the hypothesis of that book. I never read it and I never will. Narrator. Under cross-examination, he prudishly states that his belief that sex is inherently sinful. Darrow. What is a biblical evaluation of sex? Bryan. It is considered original sin. Narrator. And finally, sensing defeat, he insists upon giving a final desperate and ultimately pathetic summation and then slumps to the floor in the throes of death. The fact is, the real William Jennings Bryan was almost universally recognized as a brilliant, gracious Christian gentleman. One expert on the Scopes trial, despite the fact that he disagreed with Bryan's religious and scientific views, was nevertheless forced to admit as a speaker, Bryan radiated good-humored sincerity. In personality, he was forceful, energetic and opinionated, but genial, kindly, generous, likable, and charming. He showed a praiseworthy tolerance towards those who disagreed with him. Bryan was the greatest American orator of his time and perhaps any time. The fact is, no woman ever took the stand during the trial. More importantly, court transcripts reveal that it was Darrow, not Bryan, who was at times rude, drawing even a contempt of court citation for repeatedly interrupting and insulting the judge. The fact is, it was also Darrow, not Bryan, who prevented the scientist from testifying. Bryan had been given the right to cross-examine, and Darrow was so opposed to his experts being questioned that he never called them to the stand. The fact is, it was Bryan who introduced Darwin's book, then quoted from it as evidence in the trial. Transcripts again reveal that of the two lawyers, it was Bryan who had the better command of the meaning and the mechanism of evolution. The fact is, Bryan made no mention of sex during his testimony. Apparently, Hollywood couldn't resist introducing sex into the film, as well as the implication that the Bible-believing Christians are prudes. And finally, the fact is, Bryan gave no final speech. He did later submit a written summation that was characteristically clear and well-reasoned. He died in his sleep of an unknown cause, 5 days after the conclusion of the trial. Today, some 30 years later, television docudramas and movies, like JFK, are criticized for at times playing fast and loose with the facts in order to generate interest or perhaps push a particular point of view. I submit to you, however, that Oliver Stone in his wildest flight of fancy will be hard-pressed to equal the distorted view of history found in Inherit the Wind. The question then becomes, why? Why twist the facts in such a way to make the agnostics appear kinder, brighter, or heroic than they really were? Why the dishonest attempt to lampoon Bible-believing Christians?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it? It's the first deceptive step into getting the American people away from the knowledge of God and where our rights and freedoms come from, so that these aliens, I mean rich elites, can drag us back into slavery and tyranny. And now, the utter hypocrisy is, this lie of evolution and humanism and atheism is all we get in our education system, that again, is not only contrary to the facts of science and logic and common sense reason, but also the original beliefs, desires and wishes of our founding fathers for our country to ensure we never go back to tyranny and maintain our God-given rights and freedoms. In fact, this deceptive hypocritical humanistic stranglehold on our educational system is so entrenched, that they not only refuse to have any other view of origins like the biblical view, even though they said this was unfair, but they literally demand no intelligence be allowed in our education system either, as this man exposed.
Professor, moving through history in an unguided and undesigned way, the theory of evolution. Ben Stein, excuse me. Professor, yes, Ben. Ben Stein, how did life begin in the first place? Professor, Mr. Stein, you have the same question every time. Ben Stein, well, you never answer. Professor, we've developed it. You know we have been through this so many times. Ben Stein, could there have been an intelligent designer? Ben is sitting outside the dean's office, and a kid sitting next to him on the bench asks why he is there. His answer is, I made a movie. Narrator, join icon Ben Stein in this year's most controversial documentary film. If they value their careers, they should keep quiet about their intelligent design views. I was viewed as an intellectual terrorist. I have never been treated like this in my 30 years in academia. I lost my job. It's a funny thing that questions that aren't properly answered don't go away. Ben Stein, how do we get from an inorganic world to the world of the cell? It might have started off on the backs of crystals. Ben Stein, you have no idea how it started. No. Ben Stein, so intelligent designers believe that God is the design. God is about as unlikely as fairies, angels, hobgoblins, etc. Science makes no use of the hypothesis of God. I mean, it's essentially official policy of the National Academy of Science that religion and science will not be related. Ben Stein, there are people out there that want to keep science in a little box where it can't possibly touch a higher power, cannot possibly touch God. Back to the dean's office, the kid says, must be some movie. Expelled, no intelligence allowed.
I.e., even though science, logic, reason, facts, and common sense shows us that there really is a creator who gives us these unalienable rights and freedoms to protect us from the tyranny of man. As you saw, our so-called modern education system refuses to allow that kind of common sense intelligence. Even to the point, as you saw, they will actually fire teachers, or any staff member or faculty who has the audacity to disagree with their theory of evolution based on their own scientific discoveries. By the way, that's not science. That's not free thought nor discussing where common sense facts simply lead you. That's what's going on here, folks, in our education system. It's indoctrination, not education, into a baseless belief system designed to brainwash them against God and where our freedoms really come from, so they'll mindlessly go along with a man-centered nefarious agenda by these aliens, I mean rich elites, to control them around the whole planet with the exclusion of any intelligence. They literally want you to check your brain in at the door or you will be punished. Again, if you want even more proof on these deceptive elite tactics and the lies they're promoting in our education system, get the Ben Stein movie you saw there, No Intelligence Allowed, or our own study again called, The Witness of Creation. But again, as you can see, these kids today are not being told how to think but what to think. No intelligence is allowed because in order for these aliens, I mean rich elites, to pull off their mesmerizing of the minds of the masses to fulfill their evil nefarious agenda, they have to re-educate and brainwash the public away from biblical principles of freedom like our founding fathers set up, and instead supplant them with the humanist atheist evolutionary lies that get people to think mistakenly that our rights come from man not God. This is why they hijack the education system, and this is why we now have a whole new generation of young people called snowflakes who can't handle any differing opinions other than their own, which is really the opinions that the elites want them to have. This is why they have to have cry closets until the government bans, burns, deletes, and forbids any free thought or personal opinion outside of what the elites say should be the norm. These snowflakes are now brainwashed into thinking that the government is the one who will protect us and who should also dictate every aspect of our lives and then even promote it as a good thing for us. This brainwashed generation is simply the long-awaited for fruit of the elites' hijacking of the educational system to go along with their nefarious alien global agenda that began many decades ago. In fact, speaking of fruit, wonder of wonders, this hijacking of the education system that used to be built on biblical principles of freedom, and supplanting it with the lie of evolution, atheism and humanism not only has produced a generation of sheeples who will go along with whatever the elites want them to go along with, but it has also given rise to the immoral destructive society that God warned about that would come on the scene when you're living in the last days. As was mentioned earlier, after the Scopes monkey trial, the theory of evolution began to be taught more and more in our education system, and then in the early 60s, prayer and Bible reading were taken out. And the results have been disastrous. Let's take a look at the official behavioral statistics from the U.S. Census Bureau from about 1963 on, and you tell me if evolutionary teaching hasn't had a horrible immoral impact on our country like God warned would happen.
Back in the 1950s, the average textbook only had 2,000 to 3,000 words about evolution. But in 1963, it jumped up to 33,000 words. And it just so happened that 1963 is also when prayer and Bible reading was taken out of the American school system. What moral effect did this have on our country? Violent crimes are up 995%. The inmate population has grown from about 200,000 to nearly 2.5 million, or about 1 out of every 99 adults. America now has more people per capita in prison than any nation on earth. Unmarried couples living together are up 725%. Illegitimate births are up 400%. The divorce rate is now 60%. A murder occurs every 23 minutes. A rape occurs every 6 minutes. An aggravated assault occurs every 48 seconds. An abortion takes place every 20 seconds. A burglary occurs every 8 seconds. Sexually transmitted diseases among 10 to 14 years olds are up 385%. Unwed pregnancies among 10 to 14 years olds are up 553%. Teenage suicide is up 200%. The national average of SAT scores has dropped 80 points. Across America, 25% of graduating seniors couldn't read their diploma. Every day 13 youth commit suicide, 16 are murdered, 1,000 become mothers, 100,000 bring guns to school, 2,200 drop out of school, 500 begin using drugs, 1,000 begin drinking alcohol, 3,500 are assaulted, 630 are robbed, and 80 are raped. More people have died in America in the last 30 years from murders and suicides than from all the wars in the history of the United States.
Why? Because this is the fruit of your lies. If you lie to the kids and tell them that there is no God, and then brainwash them into thinking they came from an ape, then why are we surprised when they act like apes? What you believe determines how you behave, and if you don't believe there is a God, you're going to act like it. You're going to act ungodly. Exactly what God warned about would come on the scene when you're living in the last days. This evil humanist, atheist, evolutionary agenda has produced it. And now, people are looking around and wondering why things have gotten so violent and wicked and immoral in our country, including around the world, and it's simply because we've all been duped. We allowed our education system to get hijacked by elite humanist atheist evolutionists who have kicked God out, as this video shows.
Student. Dear God, why didn't you save the school children at Moses Lake, Washington, Bethel, Alaska, Pearl, Mississippi, West Paducah, Kentucky, Stamps, Arkansas, Jonesboro, Arkansas, Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, Fayetteville, Tennessee, Springfield, Oregon, Richmond, Virginia, Littleton, Colorado, Tabor, Alberta, Canada, Conyers, Georgia, Deming, New Mexico, Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, Santee, California, El Cajon, California, Blacksburg, Virginia. Sincerely, concerned student. Reply. Dear concerned student, I am not allowed in schools. Sincerely, God.
Narrator.
How did this get started? I think it started when Madeline Murray O'Hare complained that she didn't want any prayer in our schools. And we said okay. Then someone said, you better not read the Bible in school. The Bible says, thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. And love your neighbor as yourself. And we said okay.
Dr. Benjamin Spock said we shouldn't spank our children when they misbehave, because their personality would be warped, and you might damage their self-esteem. And we said, an expert should know what he is talking about. So, we won't spank them anymore. Then someone said, teachers and principals better not discipline our children when they misbehave. And the school administrator said no faculty member in the school better touch a student when they misbehave, because we don't want any bad publicity. And we surely don't want to be sued. And we accepted their reasoning. Then someone said, let's let our daughters get abortions when they want, and they won't even have to tell their parents. And we said, that's a grand idea. Then some wise school board member said since boys will be boys and they are going to do it, anyway, let's give our boys all the condoms they want. So, they can have all the fun they desire. And we won't have to tell their parents that they got them at school. And we said, that is another great idea. Then some of our top elected officials said, it doesn't matter what we do in private as long as we do our jobs. And we said, it doesn't matter what anyone, including the president, does in private as long as we have jobs, and the economy is good. And someone took that appreciation a step further, and published pictures of nude children and then went steps further by making them available on the internet. And we said, everyone is entitled to free speech. And the entertainment industry said, let's make TV shows and movies that promote profanity, violence, and illicit sex, and let's record music that encourages rape, drugs, murder, suicide, and satanic themes. And we said, it's just entertainment. And it has no adverse effect. Nobody takes it seriously anyway. So go right ahead. Now we are asking ourselves why our children have no conscience, they don't know right from wrong, and why it doesn't bother them to kill strangers, classmates, or even themselves. Undoubtedly, if we thought about it long and hard enough, we could figure it out. Surely it has a great deal to do with, we reap what we sow.
In other words, you lie to people there is no God. They're going to start acting like it. But this hijacking of the education system by these elite humanist atheist evolutionists, in order to brainwash people away from God and the knowledge of where our rights and freedoms come from, in order to trick us into going back into slavery and tyranny, not only is producing the fruit of the immoral society that God warned about would come upon the scene when you're living in the last days, but it has also simultaneously produced the scoffing society that God also warned about would come on the scene when you're living in the last days. And for proof of that, let me share with you some quick stats on atheism in America, and you tell me if it's getting more and more popular by our rejection of God via this lie in our education system called humanism, atheism, and evolution.
The number of Americans with no religious affiliation has grown by 25% over the past 5 years. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the number of Americans with no religion more than doubled between 1990 and 2008. A study conducted by the Barna Group discovered that nearly 60% of all Christians from 15 years of age to 29 years of age are no longer actively involved in any church. It is being projected that the percentage of Americans attending church in 2050 will be about half of what it is today. According to Lifeway Research, 46% of all Americans never even think about whether they will go to heaven or not. Atheism ads are now appearing all across America. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are being spent on billboards declaring we are good without God or don't believe in God. Join the club, or praise Darwin. Evolve beyond belief and Christianity, sadistic God, useless savior, 30,000 plus versions of truth promotes hate, calls it love just to name a few. Atheists in Florida are scrubbing away a blessing with unholy water that Christians prayed for on a highway. They say it made them uncomfortable and that they were not going to tolerate bigotry. Various atheists across the country are hosting rapture parties because if the rapture indeed occurs, and Christians worldwide are transported to heaven, we know as atheists, we are not going. If it occurs, it's a good thing for us. We get the real estate and cheap cars, and we won't have to worry about separation of church and state. There's a new website out there called www.if-jesus-returns-kill-him-again.com, where atheist Darwin Bedford, the self-proclaimed atheist messiah, states among other blasphemous things, If that self-made blank Jesus returns again, I think we should hire some Jews to throw him off the rooftop once again. Or maybe we could hire some of Mel Gibson's extras from The Passion of the Christ to punish him first. And if that doesn't work, believe it or not, there is now a new web filter out there for the internet called Godblock that blocks all religious content to protect kids from the often violent, sexual, and psychologically harmful material in many jolly texts, and from being indoctrinated into any religion. And the reason why they say they developed this device for parents and schools was because there's been a resurgence of fundamentalist religion.
So, as you can see, we now have a scoffing society who's vehemently and in many cases violently against God, Jesus, the Bible and Christian teachings. And it's gotten so bad that they are now doing such God-hating things like what I'm about to show you. The first clip is a new atheist summer camp for kids, followed by a hairdryer to baptism service by an atheist encouraging kids to scoff and mock at God, and then it goes downhill from there. Watch this.
BBC News. Wake up. It may be a summer holiday, but it's no time to lie in bed at Camp Quest. 24 children ages 7 to 17 are attacking rational thinking and a scientific approach to the world. An array of summer camp activities. They also learn cooperation, tolerance, and empathy in an atmosphere free of religious propaganda. Most of the parents are atheists and they sent their children to learn ethical behavior separate from religion. Samantha Stein, Camp Quest organizer. I think people are possibly getting tired of the influence that religion has in society, possibly an unearned influence, and they are trying to come up with alternatives. BBC. With the sun setting, it was time for a little open-air education. Mainly it is encouraging children to think skeptically and not simply to be told what to think. They are likely to talk about religion and be told that religious beliefs can hinder moral behavior. At an atheist baptism ceremony, a man dressed in blue is holding a blow dryer, holding it over the adults and kids as they are passing in front of him. He tells them not to worry, they are fine. They won't go to hell. In symbolism, he is drying off the water of the water baptism that they previously had to baptizing them. CNN Larry King, we are going to run the unedited version. And be warned, people, you may be offended. Kathy Griffin at the Emmys. Now a lot of people come up here and they thank Jesus for this award. I want you to know that no one had less to do with this award than Jesus. He didn't help me a bit. So, all I can say is, suck it, Jesus. Jesus, this award is my God now. Ken's 5 News. A program that has been turning heads and dropping jaws on the UTA campus Friday is in the home stretch. Through tomorrow, an atheist group is offering free pornography if people are willing to give up their Bibles. It made more than a few people angry, but the university said the group has not broken any rules and they should be allowed to exercise their rights. SML News. Now, is it possible to have a church without religion? The Sunday Assembly believes it is. The organization says in its gatherings it extracts the good things out of religion without making God part of the package. We went to one of their get-togethers and we discovered a church with a vicar that he doesn't believe in the existence of God either. While many people may find the idea of a godless church strange, one Anglican vicar has been preaching for over 40 years despite never believing in God. Anglican vicar. Atheism and religion don't have to be enemies. SML News. They come together regularly, and their numbers are growing. The Sunday Assembly was started by Sanderson Jones and Peter Evans months ago. Now there are 8 congregations worldwide, with the main branch in London, Sanderson Jones. We are a godless congregation that celebrates and are there for people that want to live better, help often. SML News. The idea of the assembly is to take what they call the best part of church and celebrate life, atheists and secular respective. CNN. In today's Faces of Faith, we are talking about a new kind of church. A church without God. It's called Community Mission Chapel. It looks and sounds like a place of worship. There is a weekly service, there is offerings, uplifting songs, but here is the catch. It is missing one major detail. Its members don't believe in a higher power. This self-proclaimed atheist church is just one example of the growing religiously unaffiliated congregations popping up all over the world, and it's making some waves in the heart of the Bible Belt, Lake Charles, Louisiana.
And what did God say? There would be a massive rise of scoffers towards his existence and his soon coming judgment, when you're living in the last days. And right now, we live in a world, as you just saw, where we have atheist summer camps for kids, the baptism services, celebrities openly mocking God with the audience laughing and applauding, pornography being given out instead of Bibles, and so-called atheist churches spreading across the world, even in the Bible Belt of America. Why? Because we allowed the humanist, atheist, evolutionary elites to hijack our education system, and now they have successfully brainwashed a whole generation into scoffing and mocking at God and the things of God. The aliens, I mean rich elites, have simply used the schools around the whole planet to mesmerize the minds of the masses into going along with their evil nefarious agenda. Again, anyone starting to see a pattern here with all these different forms of media? All of them are being used to control the narrative and to manipulate the minds of the masses for these elites' own nefarious purposes. This media manipulation has not only led to an increase of wickedness in the last days, like the Bible warned about, but it has also simultaneously produced a global society of scoffers towards the existence of God and his soon coming judgment. Total manipulation of the minds of the masses, across the whole planet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just by simply owning and controlling the media called newspapers, radio, and music, books, and now the whole education system. The whole planet really is being bombarded by all 5 of these forms of global media, and there's no escaping it. Unfortunately, it's about to get even worse. These aliens, I mean rich elitists, are not merely content with just owning all the newspapers, and radio broadcasts, and music industry, and books, and the education systems around the whole planet to control the minds of the masses. In their insatiable lust for power and domination, they really are literally out there amassing all forms of media in order to get the job done. Including television. It too is being used as a powerful global media tool to subliminally get us to think, act, believe, or behave the way these elites want us to. This will be the topic of our next section. And as we will soon see, the media of television is also telling us to not think for ourselves, to obey only what they want us to obey, to never question them, and of course, to scoff specifically at the Bible, God, Jesus, and his soon coming judgment. Where have I heard that before? I know it's hard to believe, but once again, keep those glasses on, and let's begin this next journey of exposing how this next form of media called television is also mesmerizing the minds of the masses.